and welcome to the Metro West Daily News podcast, part of the Wicked Local Network. I'm Megan Kelly, the digital editor for the Metro West Daily News, and I will be your host today. I'm sitting here with reporters Brad Avery.
Hello.
And Bill Shaner.
Hello.
So Brad covers Sudbury and Hudson, and Bill covers Holliston and Ashland. This is our debut podcast, and we are still kind of working on the logistics and testing out topics and technical issues, so please bear with us as we continue to do this and try this new format out. So our aim with this podcast is basically to operate as a companion to the Metro West Daily News, which is a daily newspaper out of Framingham and is also available online at MetroWestDailyNews.com, and to add another dimension or element to stories such as audio excerpts from interviews, kind of behind-the-scenes things with other reporters or photographers, that kind of thing. And we also would really love to hear your feedback. So if you're listening to this and you have any thoughts or suggestions, you can email us at MetroWest@WickedLocal.com. So today for this episode, we are going to discuss a few topics. The first will be the case of a Holliston man who was recently arrested for stockpiling weapons and threatening to kill the president. The next one will be about the drought that is going on all over the state, including how it's affecting farmers and crops out here in Metro West, Massachusetts. And then we will also be talking about some of the most read stuff on our website, including a story that you might have seen last week where a, quote, bored man was walking around a motel in Framingham naked. And then finally, we will have our segment that we're calling Around the Carrig, where we talk about the kind of things that you would discuss with your coworkers while you're all waiting for the Carrig to kick in and give you your daily dose of caffeine. So, Bill, you had a story that ran on Monday, yesterday, talking about this guy in Holliston who was arrested on a variety of charges. So why don't you tell us more about that?
Yes, the FBI came to Holliston, Sweetgrass Lane in Holliston, the very quiet little street.
That sounds like a really bucolic name for a street, doesn't it? Sweetgrass Lane.
Yeah, it's all little, you know, it's just regular neighborhood. Kids were playing in the street. There was a guy mowing his lawn. And in one of the houses, the FBI was there on Saturday carting boxes of ammunition, parts to make an AR-15 rifle, and some materials typically used to make homemade bombs. Yep, the man's name was Joseph Gargiulo. He's 40 years old, and he appeared before a federal judge on Monday. He apparently, on the internet, made threats to kill the president while he was on vacation in Martha's Vineyard, specifically playing golf. He threatened to burn down a mosque and kill everyone inside, and he threatened to bomb undisclosed police stations. Weirdly enough, that part of his plan for bombing police stations was to kill Homeland Security agents, but they're typically not at your average municipal police station.
Yeah. So where did they find these threats or rants? Or this? He published them online?
They found them in some of his online correspondence, and they also had a couple informants, people that were close to him, getting worried about him. One guy said he was, quote, about to snap. He was actually stockpiling water and food to carry out some sort of plan that would necessitate stockpiled water and food. So, yeah, I went down on Monday, and I was talking to all the neighbors, and no one had a good thing to say about him. One woman wouldn't go on the record because she was terrified of him.
So it's not a case of everyone saying, but he seemed like such a nice guy.
No, he seemed like a recluse and everyone avoided him. I heard talk of weird yelling coming from the house sometimes. He allegedly would throw bottle rockets into the street.
Were you able to find out if he lived with anyone? Like, was he married? Or
he was married. His ex-wife took a restraining order out against him. And this is This is the interesting part of the story, is that part of his restraining order was that he can't have any guns, ammunition, weapons, anything like that. So that's what the FBI got him on, that clause in his restraining order out of Rentham District Court.
So he didn't actually have any guns. He just had a lot of ammunition and, like, parts for making guns?
Yeah, he was ordering the parts online to make an AR-15, which is, like, the assault rifle that all of our lone gunmen in recent months, years have been using.
I didn't know that you could order parts online to make your own.
Yeah, you can assemble it. One of the people in the affidavit that the FBI officer wrote said he was like an ex-military kind of guy, and he said that he had everything pretty much besides the trigger apparatus built. So I don't know anything about guns, but I guess when you get the trigger apparatus built, you're good to go. No specific mosques were mentioned, and it didn't really seem from my reading that he had an actual concrete plan. I think that he was just maybe a little bit unstable.
They said that they found handwritten notes threatening yes. Muslims in the house,
yes.
too?
Yes, they unfortunately did not expand on that at all in the affidavit, but they did. Along with his trove of munitions, they found some handwritten notes threatening violence against Muslims.
Now, he had a lot of chemicals there, too, possibly for making bombs. And I was curious, you know, they mentioned that he was stockpiling water, but I don't know if that was for kind of he thought he was going to hide away in a bunker, or if the water was like a key ingredient for these types of weapons he was trying to make.
Yeah, that's definitely definitely a thing to follow up on as I follow the court proceeding. I assume that as this goes further, and it's federal court, so it's going to move pretty slow, but I assume as they still have to file an indictment against him, there still has to be an arraignment and obviously a discovery period. So I expect to know a lot more about this in the coming months.
So when you were out there yesterday, when you were talking to neighbors, was anybody there for the raid? Did anybody see the raid go down?
Yeah, a couple people said that it happened really early Saturday morning, and people said that they came in really quiet. You know, there wasn't big blue flashing lights or anything. It was just a couple FBI officers. They arrested him, and they were carting boxes of stuff out of his front door.
Do you get a sense from any of the law enforcement that you talked to that this guy was a credible threat or is just a perhaps, you know, unstable man with a lot of extra stuff?
Yeah, I don't know if they were willing to go there. I didn't see anything to that effect in the court documents. But the sense that I've gotten from people online posting about this and like the Holliston groups where everyone goes for their information these days, is that, one, they're happy that the FBI did their job, that they kind of nipped this in the bud, and two, that he was just kind of a known crazy person, for lack of a better word, in the neighborhood. So I don't know if he actually could have gone through with it. That's a big question. He had big plans, you know?
I don't see how he could even possibly done all the things he was saying he was gonna do. If he did anything, you know, he would not have gotten past, you know, one thing. It sounds like he just had all these grandiose ideas that I'm gonna do this and I'm gonna do this, and he kind of wrote his feelings down about this and making these threats. But I don't see. Maybe we'll find. You know, the FBI will unveil more what he's saying. Because right now, this is all speculation about, you know, what did he actually think his plan was going to be? Did he have this all worked out, or did he have this kind of just these ideas that were just sort of spots?
Right. Also, something in the affidavit, they mentioned that he is known to people close to him to abuse prescription medication. So these could also just be the ramblings of a person who's not so great in the head and
a troubled person
on substances.
Yeah, that's too bad.
Well, it reminds me of, you know, I think it was last month in Framingham, that guy got arrested on Indian Head Road. He had these homemade explosive devices. And
is this the guy Andrew? No, that was that in Framingham? Andrew, I forget his last name, but it was him and this other young lady who wasn't his wife.
Yep, and it was like a drug deal or something, and the dealer texted his girlfriend and, you know, made these lewd comments towards his girlfriend. And then he showed up at the guy's house in Marlboro or his apartment, and the police caught him there with one of the explosive devices in his backseat, or several of them in his backseat, and then they went to his house and they found more weapons and another explosive device, and it was over on Indian Head Road. So it's just kind of, you know, strange that this summer that we've had several types of cases like this.
Yeah.
It's Andrew Josephek.
Oh, okay.
Yes, that was it.
It was the drug deal. I just looked it up. Right. Yeah, you know, I think it's unfortunate that, you know, obviously politicians are going to be a target for mentally unwell people. But I wonder also if it could just be a coincidence. I mean, that one seemed more linked to drug stuff than any kind of political thing, but...
Yeah, it's weird. There was no politics involved in that guy. It's just making me think that guy had these explosive devices that were homemade.
Right.
And this guy was building his own guns, you know, had these chemicals involved. And, you know, there's no connection between the two of them, but it's strange that, you know, locally speaking, within just a couple towns over from each other, we've had these two big high-profile cases of someone, you know, stockpiling weapons, and we don't know what they're exactly going to do with them, and that we've, you know, had law enforcement, you know, catch them, thankfully.
Right. And maybe it's a weird, I don't know what the word is, the weird offshoot of the fact that it's so much harder to get a gun in Massachusetts, so that you have to make do with the improvised explosive devices. I don't know.
That could be it. And you know? I think it is also larger commentary on just the weapons issue in the United States right now. It's people are trying to get their hands on weapons.
Well, it's our area. It's very polarizing. I think people are probably mindful of the elections coming up, that if they think that there's going to be, like, if they think Hillary Clinton's going to win, that maybe that means there'll be even more gun control, so they want to get their stuff together.
Oh, absolutely.
You wrote about that, right?
I did write about that. I was going to bring that up. Is when was it that the Attorney General did that? Announced that AR-15, the assault rifle ban.
About a month ago.
Yeah,
and you know, it came just overnight, and it caused a massive rush on gun shops because they found out about it that morning and basically had until midnight to sell off their stock, and then it became, you know, I'm still not quite clear if it was always illegal and this was just a crackdown. I think that's what it was, but they're basically beforehand, the assault weapons ban in Massachusetts. Gun companies would make these sort of Massachusetts compliant guns that had slightly different things that kind of, it was kind of a loophole in the system that allowed them to still sell effectively the same weapons with just slightly different functions or things that were changed. And, you know, for years this has been going on. So the Attorney General doing this really blindsided the entire gun industry, locally speaking. So, and another thing is just kind of speaking to sort of the issue as it currently stands, is there's a lot of distrust, especially of the media, among sort of those communities where, you know, it was hard to get in and talk to the owner of the gun shop in Natick that I went to, because they feel like they've been burned a lot in the media. They feel like guns are being inaccurately represented in the media, and that it's causing, you know, mistrust towards something that they hold very dear as a part of really their identity and their community. Like, just going beyond sort of a hobby, it's something that they feel very much entwined with, you know, American identity. And it's sort of interesting, as, you know, we see these types of cases where people stockpile guns, and, you know, it's hard to connect those two in exactly the same way. Because I think what we see here is that we see these sort of potentially dangerous people, you know, stockpiling, and then we also see people who are just, you know, feel strongly, you know, this is just my constitutional right, this is something I grew up with, that I feel like that I should have a right to own and use responsibly. And, you know, when the AG came down with that crackdown, they rushed out and they formed these long lines that were there till midnight, because they felt that, you know, their rights are being violated. So there's sort of these two warring depictions that we see that often get conflated.
Maybe that's what Joseph Gargiulo was trying to get around when he was ordering the parts part by part, so he could construct his own, even though, I don't know, that's maybe something to look into.
So I think we pretty much got that topic, but I wanted to ask finally, Bill, if you know when the next court date is for him.
The next court date is actually, it may come before this episode comes online. The next court date is August 31st, which is tomorrow.
Okay.
And it's to find out how he's going to be held. Right now he's being held by U.S. Marshals. And the way it works in federal court is a little different than what we're used to at the district court level. There needs to be an indictment period where the government has 30 days after detaining him to draft an indictment. And then after the indictment, there's an arraignment. So that is about a month out from now. I'll be looking for that in mid to late September.
Our next topic is going to be on the drought that is affecting, I would say, almost the entire state of Massachusetts, a large part of the East Coast. Specifically, we're focusing here, of course, on the Metro West region. And both Bill and Brad have recently written stories about how the drought is affecting the local economy, local farmers, that kind of thing. And as a note, I'm not sure if this podcast will be out before then, but this coming Sunday, we are going to be running a story about how the drought is affecting apples and apple farmers. And it sounds like this year's crop will be smaller apples, and there will be fewer of them, which is a bummer. Apples are my favorite fruit.
Yep.
A week or two ago now, I did a large Sunday story on the drought. And I went out to Sherbourne, just over the line of Framingham, to Sunshine Farm. And I spoke with Jim Gagan, who's the owner and farmer there. And one thing he mentioned about apples is that pick-your-own season is probably going to be really affected by this. And he's probably only going to be able to have a few days this season.
That's a major...
I don't know if it's a few days, but limited days for sure.
That's a major revenue source and a major tourist thing for people coming from different parts of the state or different parts of New England to come pick your own apples. So,
First week of apple picking season, it is an Instagram.
I was going to say,
picking party.
Who will think of the Instagram and the children with the adorable, you know, bucket hats and that kind of thing?
But it is real, you know. I shouldn't say a few days, but it will be limited, and you may not just be able to go pick your apple any day that you choose. And a lot of farms are feeling the same exact thing. For the state level, a lot of farms have seen 30-40% of their crops that they plan to die this year.
That's huge.
If you drive by certain farms, you know, if you drive by for Julian's and Hudson, just look at the corn, and it's just dry and dead. And Mr. Gagan over at Sunshine Farm had the same issue, corn in particular. And if you've had corn this summer, a lot of it isn't as good because it's been dried out, or, you know, it survived the drought, but it suffers. And I think we tend to look at events like, you know, when we have rainstorms, we have tons of rain at once. But what we really need, and any expert in wildlife or in the environment is going to tell you this, especially over at the State Fire Department that handles wildfires, they're going to say we need sustained rain. It doesn't matter if it's just a little bit, but if it's raining slightly for a few days at a time, that gets the soil to really absorb the water again. It helps prevent forest fires, and it's going to help the plants grow. I think, as Mr. Gagan told me, that when we have these showers, these heavy rainstorms, but that only last maybe 10 minutes at most, it takes the stress off the plants, but it does nothing permanently. And what happens with soil when it gets dried out in these drought conditions is that it becomes hydrophobic. So it doesn't absorb the water as readily. And there's a lot of runoff. The water does not get deep into the soil. It really needs to be softened up and slowly reintroduced to being watered.
So, Brad, what did Mr. Gagan or anyone else who you talked to, did they have any ideas about what they're going to do? Or did they just have to kind of throw their hands up and say, oh, this is it, this is what we have?
A lot of it's the latter. Irrigation systems, a lot of farms this year have had to put in irrigation systems that didn't really have them before or maneuver them. It costs a lot of extra manpower. It's a lot more work. They're constantly trying to irrigate. They're constantly moving things around. They adjust. They roll with the punches. Farmers do. For however many millennia we've had farming, you've always rolled with the punches. But it's... a struggle, and there's nothing you can do about it is the real thing in the end, unless we get rain, and none of us are just holding back the rain. Yeah. It's
only.
It's not like there's someone saying, no, you can't have any rain. We need to pass a bill, and Congress is holding it up. Like, it's just a bad situation to be in.
Yeah, I was talking to a farmer in Holliston, Christine, at Arcadian Farm, and she was like, yeah, you know, the drought's pretty bad, but my grandparents opened this farm before the Great Depression, so I think we'll be all right.
That's a good attitude to have.
Yeah, that was the kicker. That was the kicker of my story.
We're not in a dust bowl. That's good.
It's not a dust bowl. But the corn is lousy.
Right. I mean, I hope that this is just one of those. It's going to be one of those years where, you know, droughts come and go, but right. hopefully this won't
be. It's the hottest year on record so far.
That's a whole another story.
Yeah.
We don't need to go. We don't need to go there.
Yeah. We should build a wall and have the ocean pay for it.
So, Bill. So, what was your drought story focusing on?
I wrote my drought story probably a month before Brad did, and it was when the drought was just starting to come on. So the people I talked to are a little bit more blasé about it. But back to the corn, I was going to say, the lead of my story ended up being, I saw Christine at Arcadian Farm, and she had the bed of her pickup truck was full of corn, and she had a garden hose on like shower mode. And she was just showering the corn with the garden hose. I was like, hey, why are you doing that? She's like, well, if I don't do that, they just shrivel up and die right away because they're just so dry. So I give them a bath, and that gives them a couple more weeks. Then you throw them in the freezer for a little bit, too.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, something this could also affect is cranberries. So when we're thinking ahead to Thanksgiving.
Apples and cranberries?
Yeah, apples and cranberries.
Those are like our main exports.
I was at the Drought Management Task Force meeting a few weeks ago in Boston, and that was one thing that came up is, you know, cranberry crops, they're looking at them, they haven't seen them yet, but they might be smaller than expected, so that's another issue. Funnily enough, though, there are certain crops that are doing well. Tomatoes are doing well, and strawberries did really well this year.
They need a lot of heat and a lot of sun, so that is good for them.
Actually, Holliston, a farmer in Holliston took top prize for heirloom tomatoes. Was that last week?
Yeah, it was last week.
Yes, it was last week.
Yes.
MacArthur Farm. He was like, yeah, the drought is bad for pretty much every farmer but us. We have clay soil and tomatoes like it hot and dry. So we won. So we're doing good. We like it.
That's good.
Yeah. So, silver lining. MacArthur Farm, rep that. Holliston, they've won 4 times. Best tomato farm in Massachusetts. I'll say it because I cover Holliston and I got Holliston pride.
Well, as nice as, you know, the beach days are, I'm sure, if some rain comes, just be happy that rain is here. I think that's the real takeaway is that, you know, I hate the rain, but at this point I would be happy with it.
And good rain, too.
Yeah.
Not these crazy...
Yeah, that just, you know,
fire hose damage. Rains for
yeah,
a
like,
half hour.
Lightning storms, like these lightning storms, like, have burned down houses lately that I've covered.
Right.
It's you know, that those types of storms are the exact opposite of what we need. Those cause more damage, really, than anything.
I also just want to say here, as a lazy homeowner, this drought has been amazing because it's meant that I've mowed my lawn maybe 3 times this summer.
That's true.
I have a sprinkler system, but and where I live does not have a water ban, but I felt very guilty about turning it on a lot, so
just let it die, right?
Most of my neighbors have done the same because we kind of feel like it's a little wasteful to have such that emerald green lawn in such a drought. But
it's good.
It's good if you're lazy.
Landscaping companies are really taking a hit.
We haven't really covered that aspect much.
I did a little bit of that in my story. In Milford, they introduced a water ban pretty early on. Yeah. So those companies that do landscaping, they are saying that lawns that they would do 4 times a month, they do maybe once a month now. So that's a lot of lost revenue.
The Globe had a really funny story, I think it was last week, where they talked about scofflaws in the suburbs who will turn their sprinklers on.
I gotta find that story.
In the dead of night. They focused on Hingham.
Scofflaws.
I think they talked to someone from Wayland, too, but they basically were talking about people who are wealthy enough to just pay the fine that they get and just keep watering their lawn. But also people will hang up a sign that says, you know, this property has well water. And sometimes that's true. They do have well water, but sometimes they don't have well water. Or they water their lawns in the dead of night, which they talk to some town official or gardening expert who said that that's just the absolute worst time to mow your lawn is at you know, midnight or 1 a.m. or something like that. So
right.
I thought that it was that was pretty funny. It was a good kind of tongue-in-cheek thing about...
Are they trying to crack down on that? People watering in the middle of the night?
Well, that's what they were... So people often get reported by their neighbors.
Ah.
But also the inspectors have been... Some towns have been walking around too or driving around to see who has their sprinklers on.
Yeah, they do that in Ashland.
Yeah. And I mean, to be fair, you know, I know that everyone likes having that bright green lawn, but it's not as important as... making sure we have enough food and fresh water to drink. And it was pretty funny, though. I can't imagine being so wealthy I can just say, sure, no problem. I'll just pay the fine. Let me know how much it is.
But, yeah, I remember some communities talking about the possibility of exponential fines.
Right.
So that way it's not just, oh, I pay $100 a day to do this. It's, you know, oh, you pay $100 and you pay $200, then you pay $400, then you pay $1,000.
Right, right.
How much is the lawn really worth? I mean,
well, I mean,
I might just be bitter because I don't have one, but I don't think a lawn is really worth much at all. You know,
I think that
it's worth more trouble than it.
It depends. If you have, I think if you have a dried out lawn and everyone else has a dried out lawn, it's fine. Or someone I was a party at this weekend said, as long as you have the second worst lawn in your neighborhood, you're good.
So keeping up with the Joneses kind of thing.
Right, but you don't want to have the overgrown one that's just, you know, a hiding ground for ticks and rabbits
and
squirrels and stuff like that.
Well, that's one good side effect is the tick population is down as a result.
Right,
so
right.
That's good for us.
Less Lyme disease is a good thing.
Yeah, it is. It is a good thing. But yeah, I think that you know... Realtors will talk about curb appeal, and you know, if you are trying to sell your house, you do want the whole thing to look nice. But so I feel bad if anyone was trying to sell their house this summer, we're paid enormous water bills to keep up with that. One of the most read stories that we had last week, and I think perhaps one of our most read stories of all time, was a story by our cops and crime reporter, Norman Miller, about a man who was found at the Red Roof Inn in Framingham, wandering the halls completely naked. And when police showed up to tell him to put some clothes back on and ended up arresting him for, I think it was lewd behavior, something like that.
Indecent.
He said, lewd and indecent behavior, yeah. He said that he was, quote, bored. Now... I've been bored in a hotel or a motel. I've definitely found other ways to do something rather than walk the halls. But
that wasn't your first thought?
No.
Oh, wow.
But what made this story so fascinating, just kind of from a digital standpoint, is that it got linked to on the Drudge Report, which is one of the original, I called it the OG of blog reporting to someone the other day. It is, gosh, probably almost 20 years old now, and it was the site that broke the Monica Lewinsky scandal.
Mm-hmm.
So it got linked there, and the traffic on that just it went completely viral. It helped that the headline was pretty funny, just bored man arrested for walking naked in a motel. But it was pretty good. We got a lot of comments that were defending this man's right to be naked in a hotel, which I found very entertaining.
America.
Yeah, your freedom to be naked.
Well, it's funny is that that story is the one that got linked, but there was also the woman who had no pants on that got into a car crash.
Yes.
And I was like, I think that was the same day.
Yeah,
two naked stories in one day.
Yeah, and I was on vacation last week, and I came back on Thursday, and that was a really weird, really weird duo of stories to come back to.
I think I looked at our website's analytics, and it was at like 100% more than normal.
So thank you, Matt Drudge, for bringing more traffic to our site.
Thank you, Judge. Thank you, Board Guy.
So now is our segment that we're calling Around the Keurig. Not sure about other offices, but here at the Daily News office, we have a Keurig in our break room, and it is old and
loud.
Quite slow and loud. It sounds like a small plane taking off whenever you put it on. So if you want to get coffee, you have to go in there and usually wait behind someone else, and of course... there's chit-chat. So each time we have a podcast, we're going to talk about something that we all particularly, or each of us, had read, listened to, watched, experienced in the last week or so. So, Brad, why don't you start off with what your topic is?
My recommendation is a book. It's called Hacker, Hoaxer, Whistleblower, Spy by Gabriella Coleman. aka the many Faces of Anonymous, and it's about a hacking group, Anonymous. You may have heard of them. They wear Guy Fawkes masks, based on V for Vendetta was the inspiration for that. And since 2008, they've been sort of the symbol of internet hacktivism, as we've come to know it, coming to prominence right alongside WikiLeaks at the same time. And it's a really interesting is that Gabriella Coleman is an anthropologist at McGill University. She focuses on hacker culture and on coding and sort of the modern internet. And it's this look at it that's very accessible to this culture that if you kind of grew up with it, if you were a teenager like I was in 2008 when Anonymous was attacking Scientology in Project Chanology, as it came to be known, you kind of go through this culture in this weird section as it evolved. And Gabriella Coleman got right on there. She was in IRC chat rooms with these guys, kind of watching them, making sure she avoided any time they did anything illegal. But it's a narrative of this weird subculture of hackers with these political motives who eventually, you know, a lot of them got arrested, but it keeps going because the moniker of Anonymous is not tied to any one group. Anyone can claim it. And so they launch attacks on, you know, websites of political entities they you know, find to be inhibiting freedom. There was a whole thing in the book about when they aided in the Tunisian Revolution to take down the government's websites. It's a fascinating history that I would definitely take a look at, because I think this whole cyber infrastructure is probably one of the most important things that a lot of people don't completely understand.
New territory too.
Exactly.
It's crazy how it started with 4chan, and now we're here with this quasi-criminal organization. Yeah. They're like the Robin Hoods of the internet.
One funny thing is that she has to really explain a lot of 4chan terminology and slang and like why it's deliberately offensive, and has to go into the way they operated as a culture beforehand and how they sort of grew, and it started as sort of these pranksters and then became something very kind of, you know, not quite dark, but very serious.
Yeah.
Can you imagine having to write that out and explain it to, like, your mom or your grandmother?
Right. I was just thinking if we needed to explain what 4chan is. I don't want to. You can Google it.
Don't
Google it.
Look up the Wikipedia article on 4chan if you don't know what it is.
Yeah, or if you're going to Google it, don't Google it at work.
Don't go to the website. It's just full of just lewd images that people post. It's a chat room. It's a message board. And we're
literally anything goes. And anything when we say goes. Literally anything, we mean literally. Yeah. If your mind can think of it, and it's there.
Too much. Yeah. Too much.
Okay. So, Bill, what would you like to chat around the curious this week?
I also have a book that is a compilation of a magazine, an internet magazine I've been following for a long time called The Atavist. And they publish long, they're almost like short stories. They're like 10,000, 15,000 word pieces of journalism. And this is a collection of like all of their best ones. And they're like, my favorite is one on when hippos almost became a thing in the United States.
Like as pets?
As meat. There was a meat shortage in the 1910s in some people, and it went all the way up to like a congressional hearing on the validity of bringing hippos to America because we killed all the buffalo, and at that time buffalo was a big source of meat. So it's like a 10,000 word piece on that, and they're all like those kind of things, like, almost along the lines of This American Life. Weird stories, very human stories, written in a cool style. And I think that people who like longer, long-form journalism would really be into this book.
I'm going to say that hippo thing is one of the worst ideas I've ever heard.
Oh, yeah. No, the author grapples with the fact that how bad of an idea it is. Yeah.
Yeah, just so many things. Actually, it reminds me of a story I read recently. I think it was on Vice, because of course Vice would do this, but yep. Pablo Escobar had so many hippos that Colombia now has a hippo problem because his hippos bred, and there's now a hippo population, and hippos are very violent to humans. And so
are they like an invasive species? Like they're just out. Like,
they're an invasive species in Colombia right now because of Pablo Escobar.
Wow.
So there's an article on Vice about that.
That's awesome.
If you need more reason why bringing hippos to the U.S. for meat is a bad idea.
Who knew hippos were such good fodder for journalism? It's 2016.
So my topic this week is the sad but probably not too unexpected death of actor, comedian Gene Wilder. He was 83, and he died from complications of Alzheimer's. You know, personally, I loved him. I grew up watching Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, and when I was a little bit older, my dad let me watch Blazing Saddles, and I thought it was the funniest thing I'd ever seen. But what I really liked was this note that his nephew wrote, kind of released as a statement to the press, you know, or to just the public in general. There were a couple of things that I really liked about this note. One was that he called Alzheimer's an illness pirate, which was strange, but kind of cool. But he also wrote that Gene Wilder coexisted with Alzheimer's, which I really like that. Like, I feel like a lot of times people feel like their loved one has been taken over by Alzheimer's, but he said that they were so grateful and so lucky that he never stopped recognizing his family, which is amazing. I mean, I've had a few relatives and people who have had Alzheimer's or really bad dementia, and that is the worst part, is when they don't recognize their own children or their spouse of 50 years or something like that. But he also said that, and this really kind of made me get all verklempt, that Gene Wilder didn't let anyone know, like he didn't let the press know or the public know that he had Alzheimer's, because he didn't want children to point to him and say, oh, there's Willy Wonka, and then for their parents to say, oh, that's right, he has Alzheimer's, that's really sad. Like, he wanted everyone to be happy. He wanted, if a kid pointed at him and said it's Willy Wonka, that the kid would smile and the parents would smile and they would all think about him. So I thought that was such an amazing final act for this such a talented man. So rest in peace, Gene Wilder. I hope that heaven, if it exists, is funny.
Rest in peace. Mm-hmm. The only actor that's ever scared me and been a role model in a role. When I watched Willy Wonka as a kid, I was kind of terrified of him, but I also wanted to be him. Aren't many things I can look back on my childhood like that.
You know that part where he walks out and it looks like he needs the cane, he's struggling, and then he kind of does the flip? Uh-huh. Apparently he had to talk the director into letting him do that.
Oh, that's awesome.
Because he wanted to show that everything from now on, Wonka could be completely making up. You could not trust him.
Right.
He also, for that scene, that was the first time any of the cast members had met him. So he, like, they deliberately planned that where they didn't know what to expect from that shot. And he did that and surprised them as well.
Wow. That is cool.
So no one knew about that.
Probably got some natural reaction on that.
That's great.
Yeah, that's really
cool. Oh, and I would be remiss in not mentioning the producers as well. I know that it's now like a movie that was made about the musical or something, but the original movie is fantastic, and I recommend, if you haven't seen it, to watch it.
Yeah, the musical's good, but the originals is a classic.
Thank you so much for listening today. We hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to send us your feedback to MetroWest@wickedlocal.com. And you can also find us on Facebook at Metro West Daily News. On Twitter, we're at Metro West Daily. And on Instagram, we are also at Metro West Daily. Thanks.